Our next speaker is Leo Vatchers. I'm probably mispronouncing your name horribly. The program here lists him as a consultant, but actually in doing a little bit of research on his background, I discover that he is one of the key figures in establishing institutional repositories in the Netherlands. And I'm looking very much forward to his talk about how we need to be responsible. I will signal when you are about 5 minutes to the end. Okay.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction, and also thanks to the organizers for inviting me here. Currently, I am retired, so that means that I will not be invited anymore for the position that I have, so maybe I am invited for the ideas that I have. Thank you very much for that. Okay, to begin with, I call myself the disciple of Eve. And why is that? In my perception, Eve was the first human being who really wanted to share knowledge. She wanted to know and she wanted to share. And the picture here is we see Eve at the very moment of the inauguration of the access to knowledge movement. So a very important step in the history of humans. That's why I call myself a disciple of Eve, and I think she should be the patroness of the open access movement. So, what is open access about? Open access means access to research results, so it's about knowledge, not about music or Wall Street data or whatever fiction, it's about knowledge. It should be peer-reviewed, so it's quality controlled. It should be well preserved, so not only access today, but tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. It should be internet distributed so that you have access at the very moment you need it. It should be for free use. The only barrier should be your own comprehension, and that's all. And finally, it's with attributions, so you should recognize the creator. That's what open access is about. Why is it important? What does that mean functionally? First of all, it is an expression of the corporate social responsibility of universities and research institutes that has grown over the last decade. And we see it in companies when they take care of climate or they take care of health or whatever. And in universities, the expression of corporate social responsibility is giving access to the knowledge they create, especially when that knowledge is created with publicly funded money. There is the citation advantage. Open access generates more citations, as we know now after a number of studies, gives more exposure, status, prestige, etc., to both the author and the institution. It is about science advancement. If I have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants, says Newton, and we see this quote on a regular basis. Today, the European Commission uses it, etc. What's more here is that it is an imperative, in my opinion, for enhanced publications. Imagine that you have a publication that has a piece of text, software, algorithms, research data, audiovisuals. All these components have different access rights. Then it becomes impossible to handle such a publication. So it is an absolute need for enhanced publications that all the components should be freely and openly accessible. It is a protection against abuse. This is a coin with two sides. Plagiarism is better detected if your publication is openly accessible. Imagine the classical days where someone picked a paragraph of an article from a paper journal and he included it in his own publication. Nobody would ever detect that unless the reader reminds, I have seen this paragraph before, where was it again? If the publication is openly accessible on the internet, powerful detection tools do the job for you in minutes and they find out that it is plagiarism. The other side of that coin is copyright piracy. Very soon, Driver will publish the new inventory of European repositories. And from there, in that study, it said that one-third of the articles that should be officially toll-gated are openly accessible on the internet, not because of the repositories, but mainly because individual authors publish their own articles on their own website and Google finds them all. Classical publishers call that copyright piracy. Well, in an open access environment, copyright piracy does not exist. You cannot steal oxygen from the atmosphere. Also, it eases reproduction of research. As soon as the publications are available, the reproduction of research can start, and this is ultimately the best protection against fraud and other kinds of scientific abuse. The other side of the coin is that it reduces needless duplication of research, because you can read immediately that research has been done already. So if there is so much at stake, there will be a number of stakeholders or actors as well. I return to my earlier OA picture. The research results is in the hands of authors. Publishers do the peer review. They organize it. They don't do it themselves, but they organize it. National libraries take care of preservation. Repositories, mainly in the hands of university libraries, take care of the internet distribution. Institutions, and by institutions I mean here all those who finance research, so universities or funders, they can define the conditions of publishing, so they can take care of the free reuse of publications. And finally, you have the lawyers, the Creative Commons people, etc. So all these parties are involved in the process. Today, I will focus on the role of institutions. Institutions do play a role, and quite a number of them have taken a position in the course of time. The Berlin Declaration, 5 years old now, states, "Our mission of disseminating knowledge is only half complete if the information is not made widely and readily available to society." This declaration has been signed by 260 universities now, mainly European universities. Later, we had the petition to the European Commission 2 years ago, where in 1 month's time, 20,000 individual academic people asked the European Commission to guarantee public access to publicly funded research results shortly after publication. But it were not only individuals, there were more than 500 organizations who signed that petition. And again later we have the European University Association representing 800 universities in Europe, and they say universities should develop institutional policies and strategies that foster the availability of their quality-controlled research results for the broadest possible range of users, maximizing their visibility, accessibility, and scientific impact. So institutions are taking the position, but are they doing something as well? That's an important question. What is needed for open access? I think the open access needs a machinery, a publishing machinery that has three cogwheels, so to say. There should be an open access mandate, which is a policy statement. There should be a non-proprietary review system, and I come to that in a moment, and there should be interoperable repositories. So the open access mandates are growing. and I've ticked that box for the moment. There are interoperable repositories. From the same driver study, you may learn that at the moment 50% of the European universities do have an open access, an OAI repository. So I will further focus on that middle wheel, that non-proprietary review system. And in order to find out what that means, we need to have a look in the quality control process. When an article is finalized, it will be sent by the author to an editor of a journal. And then, after a couple of weeks, the two possibilities, and even, sometimes even longer, there are two possibilities with respect to the answer. It may be a rejection. No, we will not publish your article because it's crap, but then more diplomatically formulated, of course, or it does not fit into the scope of our journal. Or the other answer may be, in principle, we are prepared to publish your article, so we will send it to our reviewers, and that is the starting of a dialogue between editor and author. And then, after an iterative process, it may go up and down for a couple of times, then there will be the message, yes, this version of the article is publishable. We are prepared to publish your article. In the current jargon, this version is called the postprint, and the original submitted version is the preprint. But together with that message, we are prepared to accept your article, there comes a kind of apropos, an attachment, because the publisher wants a little bit more by way of reward for the work he has done and he still will do. And here you see a bifurcation in the system. There is a growing number of publishers that say, yes, we want some cash for that, an amount of money. And that may vary from a couple of hundred euros up to the most expensive, $3,000, so €2,500. And after that, your article will be published in our journal that's openly available on the internet. So that's called the gold route. You may also expect, in the majority of the cases, another message. We want you to sign a little form, and then we will publish your article. Let's first have a look what that little form is, actually. Maybe you cannot read it, and but I will read it for you. It says, you, the undersigned, hereby grant the entire, complete rights to everything you have ever thought, made, or done to Acme Co. and Co. in perpetuity and throughout the universe, and even if one day they find a door in the university that leads to a whole new non-universe place, or somebody invents a time-stopping machine so that perpetuity no longer exists, or everything falls into a black hole and nobody knows which end is up, and we are all dead anyway, so who cares? We still own all these rights, so stop whining, sign or don't sign, but face reality for once in your life, because this is the way the world works, pal. You might think that is a caricature and the wordings are a little bit caricatural, but this is in fact what authors sign. They give away their copyrights exclusively for all media, paper, digital, optical, and future media, irreversibly. So this is exactly what happens. And the consequences are far, far-reaching if an author has done so, because from that very moment, he has no longer any rights with respect to his own publication. He's fully dependent on permission of the publisher who owns the rights. And what that means, you can learn from the Sherpa Romeo website. All publishers have different copyright policies. And in order to get a little bit, to sort out the situation, Sherpa Romeo have given colors to publishers. So they make a distinction between white publishers. They want your copyrights, but they allow nothing, never. I would call them black publishers, by the way. Yellow publishers, they require your copyrights and they allow you to circulate your preprints. The blue ones allow you to circulate the postprints, and the green ones allow you to circulate both versions. But that does not say all, because they also have different embargo periods. They do not immediately allow you to circulate preprints or postprints, but maybe after half a year or after 2 years. And the reuse conditions vary between publishers. You may only post it on your own website, or you may only post it on the institutional website. You may reuse it in educational situations, but not elsewhere. So there's a great variety in that as well. And what's more, changes and exceptions can be negotiated between the author and the publisher. The situation is that there are more copyright policies than there are publishers, because some publishers have different copyright policies for different journals. For authors, this situation is quite incomprehensible, I could say. So now back to the gold and green situation. Now we know what the consequences are of giving away your copyrights. In the gold route, authors retain copyrights. Institutes or projects pay for publication fees. And there is immediate open access to the published article. And this holds for about 15% of the journals today. The green situation is that the publishers get the copyrights, the institution pays for subscription or license fees, and there is delayed or embargoed access to author manuscripts, the preprint or the postprint, but not to the published version. And this is the case for 65% of the journals, and the missing 20% is the white situation, the white publishers who do not allow anything. So reducing the difference further to the bare bone, so to say, gold publishing is the natural result, gold open access, of a non-proprietary review system, a system that does not take your copyright in exchange for reviewing your article. So there are no barriers between the knowledge creator and the knowledge user. Green is the uneasy, contrived result of a proprietary review system with fences, toll gates, embargoes, and tunnels. And it is not meant, it is not designed for open access, and you can never reach open access in that system. You can, well, have an allusion to open access, because you may, after some time, circulate some versions, but that's it. So we have looked into the functional differences now. Let's have a short look at the financial consequences of green and gold, of open access and subscription-based publication. And again, I focus on the consequences for the institutes. In the open access world, an institute has to pay publication fees for every publication that the institute wants to be published in a peer-reviewed journal. They have to pay a price. And there is an interesting price list published by Biomed Central. So you can go there. By the way, all the words that are underlined in my presentation are links. So if you click there on that price comparison thing, it will bring you to the price list that is published by Biomed Central. And it gives you a very good impression. And, well, it depends on the discipline, of course, but an average of €1,300 per article is reasonable. In the subscription world, the institution has to pay for subscriptions and licenses. But that's not the only thing. If they do not have a subscription to a journal, they have to order individual articles, and they have to pay a price. If they order it via interlibrary loan, it's 10 euro. If they do so directly from the publisher, it's 20 euro per article. They have to pay copyright clearance fee as soon as you, for example, use the material in an educational environment for readers or course packs. You have to pay extra on top of that to copyright clearance institutes. And there are the contractual costs, and these are considerable. In the subscription world, you have to define your collection. So first you have to sit with researchers and say, we don't have money to buy everything, so please help us to define our collection. Lengthy sessions. Then when you know what your collection is, you have to go to a publisher and subscribe and to individual journals with the administration that comes with that, or to negotiate a license, which are lengthy negotiations and result in contracts of 10 pages or longer full with juridical crap like authorized users, walk-in users, site users, and all this nonsense, etc. And then you have to shield your content by way of passwords or IP addresses, proxy servers, etc. These are all costs that are directly involved to the subscription situation. And I invited two institutes in the Netherlands to do this calculation. And I invited two at the extreme ends of the spectrum. So one is a rather small educational institute, the Institute of Social Studies in The Hague. And maybe you cannot read it, but it is, they have 400 students per year. It is an international graduate school, and they publish not very much, 60 articles in peer-reviewed journals annually. And the manager of that institute did this calculation for me. So in his approach, he says, when we live in an open access world, I have to pay the publication fee for these 60 articles. And his guess is that the publication fee is 2,000 euro per article, which is, in my opinion, way too high, especially in the social sciences. And even more if you know that about half of the open access journals do not charge, a little bit more than half, do not charge a publication fee anyway because they are subsidized by their university or even by companies who want to have a certain knowledge circulated freely, etc. So that's way too high. But still, nevertheless, this is his guess. So I take it for what it is. And he says, I also need a platform or something to aggregate those articles that are interesting for my institute, so that's also costing money. So it's 120,000 plus 25,000, 145,000 annually. Today he pays for subscriptions 180,000. The document supply and copyright clearance fees are 65,000. And then collection management, so negotiating the licenses and handling the subscriptions, etc., is 60,000. So that's 305,000. So for this institute, as everybody expects, a small, hardly publishing institute, open access is a lot cheaper than the subscription situation. Then at the other end of the spectrum, we went to the biggest university in the Netherlands, a prestigious research university. In many lists, rankings, at the top of the Dutch universities. They publish 5,000 articles per year, peer-reviewed articles. Of these, 1,500 are the result from externally funded research. So what are their figures? If we look to the subscription side, they pay for subscriptions and licenses $4.5 million. And all the other things, document supply, copyright clearance fee, collection management, together $1 million, which adds up to €5.5 million. Oei, 5 minutes. Okay, then I'm going to speed it up, but the message here is that it is more expensive for them unless funders, research funders, take their part of the deal and are prepared to pay for the publications that are the result of their research, because then it will be lower for the. So it is nuanced. It's not certainly the case that for a research institute it's always more expensive in the open access world. It may be even cheaper. Then I skip this one. And I focus further on the research institutes, funders and universities. And here you see a whole list of funders and universities that have mandated open access now. The Wellcome Trust, research councils in the UK, Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft, Max Planck Gesellschaft, Harvard Faculty of Arts and Sciences, Irish Research Council, etc. And for the complete list, I refer you to the Sherpa Romeo website. For the moment, I want to focus further on the European Commission as a big research funder. It is an example because they more or less take the same position as the other research funders do that mandate open access. So let's see what the European Commission actually wants. They started an open access pilot in the autumn of last year. This initiative covers 20% of their research budget of 50 billion, which means about 10 billion of research is covered by that open access mandate. And if you take 100,000 research investment as the investment for one publication, which is about an average, then you see that we are talking about 100,000 peer-reviewed articles in the duration of that project, 7 years. What does the Commission offer? They mandate open access, but what do they offer? They are prepared to pay the publication fee for gold open access, and they offer a fallback pan-European repository for authors that do not have an institutional repository in their own university, which is about the case for half of the universities. What do they require instead? 15% can be published in open access, and for that gold article, so to say, the Commission requires that researchers deposit and make available their final published articles immediately upon publication. In this case, it's easy. The publication machinery is intact. There is an open access mandate, there is a non-proprietary review system, and there is an interoperable repository. But let's go to the big majority, 85,000 manuscripts. Here the Commission requires, and it's a literal quote, researchers should make their best efforts to negotiate copyright and licensing conditions for embargoed open access to their manuscript that meets the requirements of the Commission. I think this is an unfair position that you maneuver the authors in. There is an open access mandate, yes. There is a repository, yes. But the middle wheel is not functioning. Let's have a look at that. Because what is the case for these 85,000 manuscripts? 20,000 of them, statistically, have to deal with white publishers who do not allow anything. 10,000 have to go to yellow publishers, 15,000 to blue, and 40,000 to green. You may add the last two, blue and green, because they both allow open access in the end to postprints, and that's what the Commission wants. So 45,000, a small majority, are allowed ultimately to give access to the postprints. But still, it is not sure that that will be within the embargo periods that the Commission requires, half a year for certain disciplines and 1 year for other disciplines. And the other 30,000 have really to negotiate very hard because their publishers do not want what the Commission requires. So this is what the Commission actually says. Go to your publishers and try to get better conditions. Effectively, what they say to these researchers is, sorry guys, your 2007 petition was misaddressed. Send it to your publishers. I think this position is absolutely not necessary. The defect publishing machinery can easily be repaired with a well-known tool, tender non-proprietary review systems. The Commission tendered for a pan-European repository because they want to cover also the cases that there was no repository in place. You can do exactly the same for the review systems. So imagine the following advertisement in European newspapers. The European FP7 program will result in a stream of publications. For 7 areas of research, the Commission requires that these publications are openly accessible reviewed articles. In order to have appropriate review procedures in place for these articles, the Commission wants to tender the reviewing process under the following conditions. 1. The reviewing process must be independent, rigorous, and swift. The reviewing may be anonymous, the classical variant, may be open, the new variant, or maybe something in between, named, so that an article does not only have authors, but you can also see the reviewers of that article without being able to read the review itself. But that can be negotiated. As a result of the reviewing, articles will be marked 1 to 5. 1 again is crap. 2 means maybe we can publish that after serious rewriting of the article. 3 means it's good. 4 means it's very good, and 5 means an excellent article. Articles with marks 3 to 5 will be published in an open access journal and deposited in a certified institutional or European repository. In future review procedures, the Commission will weigh articles with marks 3, 4, and 5 as if they were published in journals with impact factors 1 to 3, 4 to 8, 9 to 15. These figures must be calibrated according to the culture in the discipline because the disciplinary cultures are different in this respect. That means that that new system will match with the classical system and these new journals will have a prestige from the very beginning. So that's a very important aspect, of course. Alternatively, authors may publish their articles in any existing journal, so they are not forced to publish there. You may expect 100,000 articles. Possibly, several contracts will be allocated. For different disciplines, we may have different contracts so that you can meet the differences in disciplines. And the Commission will seek the advice of important European scientific bodies like the European Research Advisory Board, University Association, etc. What will be the result? One more slide. What will be the result of this process? 100 to 200 new open access journals. Is that enough? Well, you can make the following calculation. We need an outlet for 85,000 articles in 7 years, which is 12,000 per year. An active journal can publish 100 articles per year. And especially an open access journal, digital journal, because that can easily be scaled. So that means 120 journals will do the job. So that's enough. Articles will be relieved. There's a level playing field for authors. There's no authors anymore that are privileged because they can publish in an open access journal and authors that are in a bad position because they have to negotiate all that stuff with their publisher. The citations will be recognized because one of the fears of authors is that when they circulate their one of their manuscripts, the citations of that manuscript will not be counted in the official impact factories like ISI or Scopus. Universities can be proud. There's new opportunities for publishers. The Commission acts proactive instead of just passively waiting what will happen, and that's one of their roles, I should say. And for funders, other funders will be very interested to know what the outcome is, because this result is much, very much scalable. So that brings me to my final slide. Something went wrong there, but maybe you have any answers, because I have some questions. Did I make myself clear? And have I overlooked essentials? And the ultimate question, of course, is, especially to funders, what are you waiting for? Thank you very much.
Very much. We have time for one quick question. Yes, please.
I'm Andrei Zemsko from Russian SciTech Library. Dr. Weyers.
You need to speak into the microphone a bit more.
I try. In your two examples, maybe I missed something, you compare incomparable, because in left part of small institution and Utrecht University, the count of open access mean, for me, cost of publishing, self-publishing, or cost of publicity. And in right part of the same example, it is cost of knowledge, cost of publications by other authors. Am I right? You compare incomparable.
I don't understand the question. What I did is all other circumstances are equal. So the costs of writing an article or the cost of branding, etc., are equal. The only difference that it makes for an institution is in the open access world, they have to pay publication fees per article, and in the subscription world, they have to pay subscriptions. All the other things, in my opinion, are equal.
I thought what we could discuss.
Okay.
I'm afraid we are over our time. Is this a very, very urgent question? And a very quick answer, please.
Jeannette Frey of the BCU Lausanne. In Switzerland, we have a discussion going on over functions of national consortium and national licenses. Did you ever thought about having a national consortium negotiating the Golden Road with all great editors?
Yes, absolutely. I think that consortiums of universities or consortiums of funders can do exactly the same and tender this process of a non-proprietary peer review. In fact, CERN did it in a way. They did it only for 8 or 9 journals in the Scope project. So they could, from the beginning, focus on existing journals, and they negotiated with the publishers the conversion from the subscription system to the open access system. And so, yeah, you can do that with a national consortium, absolutely. And I would strongly advise you to do that.
Thank you.